You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson on today's show.
We are here to support the Kurdish people in Syria, and we will be here till they find a resolution from the United Nations.
Turkish politicians go on hunger strike in Geneva there to show their solidarity with Kurds in Syria. My studio guests, Jane Kinnamont and Robert Fox, will unpack the situation on the Syrian-Turkish border. Also ahead, we'll ask why Tony Blair believes he's the one to ask about putting boots on the ground in the region.
All of our experience teaches us that unless you're prepared to fight these people on the ground, you may contain them, but you won't defeat them.
Plus, we look at Iran's fresh nuclear ambitions and protests in Russia as well. And we get the latest from Madrid from our man there, and we talk to the philosopher Simon Critchley and a little bit of news from the art world too. That's all coming up here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So a busy 60 minutes or so, but first let's get the latest world news now from James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The UN Refugee Agency says Turkey urgently needs to help to care for 130,000 Syrian refugees who've crossed the border in recent days. The UNHCR said this was the largest influx in such a short period since the start of the Syrian conflict in 2011. The Kurdish refugees are fleeing and advanced by Islamic State militants who've seized swathes of Iraq and Syria in recent months. Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair has told correspondents that airstrikes alone might not be enough to contain Islamic State. He said the West should not rule out the use of special force capability. President Obama has previously ruled out the involvement of US ground troops and has instead promised to provide arms and training to local forces fighting against IS. Thousands of students in Hong Kong have converged on a university campus to begin a week-long boycott of classes. They're protesting against China's stance on electoral reform in the territory. Students from more than two dozen institutions are taking part. The demonstration at the Chinese University of Hong Kong campus in Sha Tin is being seen as a rehearsal for a larger protest on the 1st of October, planned by the pro-democracy group Occupy Central. Third-year student Sunny Chan says he had no choice but to demonstrate.
There is simply no other way for us to respond as a student. I've been to many demonstrations and protests in Hong Kong, and I think that this is the last thing that we can do to voice out our stance for universal suffrage.
Ukraine is preparing to withdraw heavy weaponry away from separatist rebel lines in the east, according to the military. The two sides agreed on Saturday to set up a buffer zone in eastern Ukraine more than a fortnight after a shaky ceasefire came into force. Although the truce is still in place, clashes have continued around the cities of Donetsk and Mariupol. A security source in Libya says at least 11 people have been killed by an accidental blast at a military base in the eastern city of Al Baida. The source said a preliminary investigation showed the explosion may have been caused by high temperatures in a weapons storage area at the base. Many Nigerian schools have reopened following an Ebola break to help stem the spread of the virus. Private schools have stepped up their screening and education efforts for parents and students alike. In the capital, Abuja, parents taking their children to the school, including Pedro Charles Babajide, said they'd been made aware of the new guidelines.
It was initially when you come, you are being allowed to the school compound. But now, to actually prevent such outbreak, you are not allowed to go in. You park your car outside, and from the gate, your temperature is being, you know, measured. And I can see that when I went in, I saw, you know, the environment is very clean, and every other thing they put in place. So there's no fear. There's no cause for alarm.
In Sierra Leone, 130 new cases of Ebola were recorded during the previous 3 days of lockdown in the capital, Freetown. World Health Organization officials hailed the action as a success. Relatives of German victims of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, which was downed over Ukraine, plan to sue the country and its president for manslaughter by negligence in 298 cases. The lawyer representing them, Professor of Aviation Law Elmar Giamula, says that under international law, Ukraine should have closed its airspace if it could not guarantee the safety of flights.
If the government has such an indication that these things happen in the own state territory, then the government has the obligation to react. So insofar, the government, the European government, is to blame for not having closed the airspace.
And unions representing striking French pilots have rejected Air France's move to delay the contested rollout of its low-cost operations and vowed to stay on strike in defence of French pay and conditions. That's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. James will be back at the bottom of the hour with a quick roundup of the news headlines. You're listening to Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
The time here in London is 18.06. If you're having lunch in New York, you'll know full well that it's 13.06. Joining me now with their take on the news, making themselves comfortable here in Studio One, are Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House here in London, and Robert Fox, a defence correspondent at London's Evening Standard. We start with the conflict in northern Iraq and Syria, producing this weekend another painful wave of casualties, this time at the Syrian-Turkish border, closed today to the thousands of Kurdish refugees fleeing the brutality of the Islamic State. Let me begin with you, Jane. This is a rapidly escalating problem, isn't it? Things have just taken an astonishing turn for the worse. Fleeing to Turkey, which has already taken, more than a million refugees?
Well, you know, when Syria is back in the headlines, it's because things have got to an unbelievably bad deterioration. Turkey has already got nearly half of the 3 million displaced Syrians. Now you're seeing reports that possibly 10,000 people in 2 days have gone across that border.
I mean, there are reports, I mean, up to 100,000 have been trying in the last few weeks. The border is closed, Robert, yet there just seems to be this issue where the fact is that these people who are trying to get across are Kurds, and that is what seems to be an even more difficult twist to the whole tale.
It's very difficult. There's a very strong full-page editorial in the New York Times today in which it does use that old cliche, but it really does work here, of the Rubik's Cube, where nothing fits quite. And the place where it least fits with Turkey, we were talking about it before coming in here, The Kurdish mosaic is looking incredibly complex, and it does look that in this area of the northwest, ISIS forces are making a real push. And it's interesting to see which of the Kurdish elements are really putting up the fight. And once again, it seems to be the PKK and not the Peshmerga as such. And the PKK have been very, very reliant in this recent upsurge in support both from Iran and from Hezbollah. So when you get cliches from British politicians like Malcolm Rifkin and former heads of British forces like Lord Dunnett saying, "My enemy's enemy is my friend, so let's get alongside Bashar al-Assad," it is ever so much worse than that and much more complex, because there are side deals being done all over the place. And of course, the relations between parts of ISIS in Syria and the regime are extremely complex. I shouldn't speak in riddles and euphemisms there. The accusation is that there has been collaboration because they've identified common enemies like the Kurds, and particularly like moderate Syrian insurgent forces, like the Free Syrian Army. And there is no doubt that there has been collusion. But you have the pressure of the refugees. And the other thing I'd like to bring up while we're talking about the Turkish segment of the programme is that we must mention the release of the hostages, but more important is the flow of Turkish recruits to ISIS, which has been heavily identified by a number of extremely accurate reports, and a very powerful one in the New York Times about 10 days ago by their local correspondent, a great correspondent, and she spent a lot of time actually inside Syria and Iraq, and she has been vilified and called a traitor and a foreign agent on the front pages of the pro-Erdogan press, that is the press of the in the president's pocket in Turkey. So you've got about five different elements there, which to absolutely echo what Jane has said, it's getting worse.
Jane, just listening to what Robert was saying, and he mentioned the release of hostages. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, this is a release of 49 diplomats released over the weekend, all of whom had been in Islamic State's custody for 3 months. But somehow miraculously seem to escape, be sort of let back over the border again. Robert also mentioned the fact that there are reports of collusion by the Turkish authorities. I mean, if this were true, how devastating, how damaging would this be to Turkey's role on the world stage?
Well, we know that some European hostages have been freed because ransoms have been paid. So we don't know what's happened in this case with Turkey, but that's definitely one of the possibilities.
Because you have hostages who are released, but you don't have 49 of them being released all in one go, do you? You have them piecemeal.
That's right, but I don't think you've had an equivalent of this kind of large, important group of people. And it's been something that's been hampering Turkey's ability to respond to the Islamic State. I think they do have a somewhat ambiguous attitude towards it, but they also know that it is a threat to Turkey. I mean, I think you've seen that, you know, several of the Sunni Muslim states in the region sponsored Islamist groups to fight Assad, not thinking that they could come back to bite them too. And I think they've all had a wake-up call from the speed at which IS has expanded. They will certainly be worried that IS could become a force that would have blowback. You have had, you know, Islamist bombings in Turkey previously. But at the same time, they still really want Assad to go, and they don't quite know who to back in this, as Robert's saying, very, very fragmented conflict.
So in that context, Robert, is this perhaps Turkey simply protecting its own but unsure as to which way to go, given the fact that, as you say, it has also been one of the principal recipients of so many of the refugees from Syria?
Refugees are the products of conflicts, and they're also catalysts and triggers to conflicts. And I agree with Jane entirely. I think that this is what Turkey must fear. And they must fear because there is an Islamic turn of the regime in Turkey, particularly with the rise and rise of Erdogan, and now elected president very recently, and trying to turn it into an executive presidency, a very different kind of republic. But to go back to what the New York Times reporter reported, Ceyhan Yenginsu, this is the Achilles heel. She reported a large flow of recruits to ISIS going the other way. And a colleague, a very prominent Turkish novelist, I was on a program with the other day, her sister is still in Turkey, and it coincides with these reports. It is single-parent families very often, and they are quite common in the banlieue, in the really poor suburbs of the big cities, but principally Ankara and Istanbul. I know they're the obvious ones, but it really does seem to be happening there. They are taking their young families, lock, stock and barrel, across the border, because that's where they want their children to grow up as the sons and daughters of the new caliphate. This, it's a powder keg. That's a cliche, but it really is the quintessence of the internal and external security problem and threat, actual threat, as Jane was saying, posed by ISIS, of a grand order. It's of a much grander order from what we're sensing in Europe. And we talk about it so much, and we are worried, of course, by the flow of recruits going from countries like Britain. But it isn't just countries like Britain. Do you know the per head of population, the highest proportion of jihadis going to this particular cause? It's from Finland. Similarly, that's why Mr. Abbott of Australia volunteered, because he forces to join the coalition. Because they have identified, and so it is, there is a major jihadi problem there, Jane, in Australia.
Jane, briefly, before we move on to Tony Blair's resurgence this morning, which many people in the United Kingdom woke up to believing that they'd been transported strangely back to 2003. Just thinking of a problem this complex, trying to get your head around it, as a research fellow, where would you recommend those trying to unpick this mess look to for solutions? Where's the context? Where has this happened before and been resolved?
Well, where has it happened before and been resolved? I mean, I guess not that many civil wars have had quite so much international interest. I think quite a few of the diplomats that have been looking at Syria are informed by looking at Bosnia, and have also mentioned that it took some years, but that intervention came into the former Yugoslavia after a few years when many people would thought it wouldn't happen. I think you're seeing something similar in terms of a lid being taken off and simmering ethnic problems that have been there previously suddenly seem to be appearing out of nowhere. But, you know, there aren't really any quick fix models. I just think it is extremely important for people to remember what you see in the papers is going to be quite different from this very complex reality on the ground. And there might actually be some opportunities out of that.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 1816. Jane Kinnaman and Robert Fox are my guests today. Let's look elsewhere in today's news. It seemed to be an exercise in turning back the clock. Who would have thought that 11 years after the US-led invasion of Iraq, the British former Prime Minister Tony Blair was making the case for the possibility of British and American forces playing a direct part in the conflict against Islamic State. Janie had a point. Airstrikes aren't really enough, are they?
Well, I really hate to be starting my comment off this way, but yes, on this, Blair's right. But I don't think that any country does have the appetite to go in with ground forces, and the people who should be doing it, the Iraqi army, it's highly questionable whether they would be able to do it. This is why you see Iraq has actually turned to Iran, and there are Iranian militias sort of taking on IS on the ground. But I don't think that's going to change much. I think the international strategy is really going to be about containing IS and not about destroying it.
And to what degree, Robert Fox, is the UN Middle East peace envoy since 2007, the man from the Faith Foundation website, going to be the man who had it right all along when it came to Iraq and boots on the ground now?
You've read my column in the Evening Standard this afternoon. He is not being Tony Blair, the very astute politician, which he was in long periods of his premiership until 2003 happened. This is the man of conviction and faith. This is the sad part of this story, what we learn from the past. We learn from the past not to make a load of mistakes again, I suppose. And what's odd about this, it is just a rerun of the Samuel P. Huntington thesis of the Clash of Civilizations. Actually, there's very little in this that in their mode in 2003 and what they've been saying recently that Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney would disagree with. What I think is so strange from Blair, and he is a man of great conviction, I would have thought tolerance is a key part of both Christianity and Islam. He's talking about building a wall between the West, and he's saying you must take on Islamic extremism, which he calls Islamism, fair enough, wherever it appears, and you must be prepared to fight it. Practically turning Cameron on his head, boots on the ground. And it is, curiously, although it's a tremendous weaving of words which goes on, I have read all 6,500 words of it.
Well done.
It goes on,
it goes on and on.
And it's a hurdy-gurdy in the end. He makes some interesting and astute points. He makes some obvious points. There must be local forces on the ground. But how you manage to be interlocutor, how you manage the dialogue, which has tried faith organisations like the Sant'Egidio Foundation in Rome, which has been extremely successful, resolved one of the conflicts of a similar nature in Algeria. What is so disappointing? Actually, you get into the guts of it and he's justifying his role in overthrowing Saddam because he had to be overthrown. The tyrants have to be overthrown. And now the tyranny of Islamism has to be overthrown. he is a bit of a Johnny One Note. And by the way, the Chilcot inquiry into Iraq is expected at the turn of the year.
Simmering on the back burner, ready to be let loose. Jane, just listening, the notes I remember when I scribbled down when I was listening to him this morning was like, very impressive. The barrister is back, showing the likes of Obama and Cameron up. I mean, were these words not coming from Tony Blair, how convinced would we all be?
Well, there are certainly others making the argument that it's all about ideology and sectarianism. And this is very convenient for Western policymakers to propound. Maybe there's some truth in it, but blaming everything on religious hatred also obscures the role of politics, including Western policies, and obscures the role of the invasion of Iraq and the total dismantling of the state, the dismantling of the Iraqi army in 2003. And the failure to rebuild that has left Iraq today without a functioning army dependent on foreign intervention, be it from the US or from Iran.
You're listening to Midori House, where the time is 18:20 here in London. More from Jane Kinnaman and Robert Fox in just a moment, where we examine how Iran might be using Islamic State as a bargaining tool in its plans for uranium enrichment.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Jane Kinnaman and Robert Fox. Now, before the break, we discussed how Turkey may well have altered its image for being boxed in by the world stage due to its handling of the refugee crisis on the border with Syria. Well, another country may be trying to change its position with regards to IS, but to its advantage. Reuters today is reporting that Iran is prepared to talk to the United States about how it may help with the crisis in northern Iraq and Syria. But there's a condition of a little more flexibility when it comes to the world's view on its nuclear enrichment programme. Robert Fox, the diplomatic dance begins. Would it always have been impossible to separate the issue of uranium enrichment and help on IS?
Well, I know sitting opposite me is somebody far more expert in this than I am. And I went to an excellent seminar, which Jane conducted at Chatham House on the the nuclear negotiations. And very interesting it was, too. But just standing back and as an observer, and I would throw in my two penny worth, I think this is absolutely so. Your proposition is absolutely clear. Because what is the game of Iran? And isn't it interesting how so much more successfully it's been conducted by Rouhani and Zarif? It's to break out of isolation. It is this thing that, you know, we have been boxed up at the east end, the northeast end of the Gulf, quite unfairly. We're a great nation. We need to have our place in the sun. And these two have played it very, very cleverly. What I think everybody recognises, from Cameron through to Obama, through to Blair, through to whoever you name, and Putin, most important, Hollande and Erdogan, Tehran is really needed. It's really needed for several reasons, because it has some grip on training and helping forces. It has a very important hold over the future of politics in Baghdad, because they really do have a hold on the Dawa Party. And it seems to be that we can only get prime ministers from the Dawa Party for Iraq. And it's very, very interesting that the rhetoric for so much of the noughties after the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was that this thing was being, this great new democracy was being destroyed by the subversion of Iran. And we were at war with Iran, I quote General Rick Sanchez. And now, we're looking at the possibility that Iran, rather than what goes on the other side of the Gulf, the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation countries, are the people who may hold the key to holding Iraq together. And that's why they're needed. What I suspect, I really hope is going on, and there's a two-track going on here. There will be the overt diplomacy. We will hear all this kind of stuff from time to time. But I damn well hope that there is some really serious covert diplomacy going on with people of the quality and brains which we lack in our generation, but people like James Baker, who was so good at doing this. I suppose Dick Holbrooke was the last one, a bruiser of a diplomat that is prepared to really say, what are your strong points? What are your weak points? What are mine? This is how we're going to play cards.
Jane Kinnaman, your part having been rather beautifully built up by Robert Fox there. I mean, he was... Robert, just to summarise you very quickly, you were basically saying that we need Tehran more than Tehran needs us. Is he right?
As much as each other, I would say. Sorry.
Well, Iran is going to fight IS anyway. It's in Iran's interest to defend the government in Iraq, which is its main state ally in the entire world, now that Assad is so much weakened in Syria. So I think that to bring it up in this way, as, you know, we might want a quid pro quo for this, is actually surprisingly crude for, you know, such generally expert negotiators. I do think it will affect the mood around the negotiations, but I think the negotiators themselves want to keep it, the talks that very firmly focused on nuclear programme and on possible sanctions relief, and to try to keep the regional politics out of it.
Explain to me a little bit, though, about Tehran's official and unofficial positions. Obviously, we've heard rejections by Tehran of what was an offer from the United States. The United States denying that an offer was ever made. We have a domestic issue as well in Iran, where you have a Shia majority who ostensibly are the idea of, you know, the embodiment of apostasy to Islamic State. But Iran turns its back sometimes, doesn't it? It turns a bit of a blind eye to Sunni extremism.
They have been able to exploit Sunni extremism sometimes as an opportunity, as I think other states in the region have as well. We talked about Turkey and some of the Gulf states thinking that IS might be useful against Assad. And I think similarly for Iran, you know, IS has been a force that has discredited the wider Syrian opposition. So certainly it used to be useful. But I think now that it's got to this size, it's become more frightening for Iran. They do have a worry about whether it could come and bite them in its own territory. When they speak to their own people about backing Assad, they say we need to fight the jihadis in Syria because otherwise we're going to be fighting them inside our country. And that's something that makes even Iranians who don't much like their regime think, yes, maybe we should be on Assad's side because better the devil we know.
Finally, in this half hour, we look at the protests taking place in Moscow. There were reports of thousands of people gathering in the Russian capital streets on Sunday, angry at their nation's conduct in Ukraine. Robert Fox, who were these protesters? Were they the middle-class thinkers which drive Moscow's society and those who took to the streets 2 years ago?
It's very similar to Afghanistan. These are the mothers and relations of the Afghansi, the people who've lost people in a war which has been concealed from the Moscow public. Mm. And that is the most serious thing. And it's very dangerous. It's qualitative, not quantitative, I grant you. But it is the first big crack in Putin, the new czar, speaking for the nation, speaking for Novi Russia, whom he's praised, the people on the right, who he seems to have been so worried about. The fact is that the people who have put, to use Cameron's favourite phrase, boots on the ground, and yes, it's absolutely clear, a lot more soldiers went in than we ever realised at the time, and a lot more have been killed and very seriously injured. Look at the toll, proportionately, that the UK is suffering very seriously injured returnees from Afghanistan and Iraq, which is going to be a problem that will be enduring for some time. It is both qualitative and quantitative. But the fact that they have broken through the crust, that these protests have been noticed, and the media hasn't been shut down entirely, really is very significant. It's not going to change things overnight, but I think Putin, great opportunist may exploit it and say, enough already, let's actually go firm on lines, because more or less he's got what he wants for the time being.
Jane, would you agree with that, that this protest was in fact prompted by perhaps the number of Russian soldiers killed that we didn't really know about? Or is it more, as was widely reported in the media, a demand that Ukraine be allowed to turn itself more towards Europe?
Well, here I think I defer to Robert's greater knowledge on this one, but I think that the presence of relatives of dead soldiers has made it particularly difficult to crack down on, because it's very, very hard to discredit.
And they were very prominent. The portraits were very prominent, yeah.
I think it's quite convenient in the West, I guess, to focus on pro-Western people who think, hey, Ukraine should be allowed to be part of Europe. I doubt this is really a huge constituency in Russia. It would also be quite convenient for Putin to paint the protests that way and to say that they're kind of traitors and not nationalists and so forth. But when you have relatives of dead soldiers, it's really difficult to undermine them for a nationalist leader.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Jane Kinnamont and Robert Fox, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll be checking in with our man in Madrid, hearing the latest from the art world, and talking to the author of a slim but weighty book on philosophy. It involves boxes, astrology and a small theatre. But before we get started on all that, James has the latest.
The UN Refugee Agency says Turkey urgently needs help to care for 130,000 Syrian refugees who've crossed the border in recent days. The UNHCR said this was the largest influx in such a short period since the start of the Syrian conflict in 2011. Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair has told correspondents that airstrikes alone might not be enough to contain Islamic State. He said the West should not rule out the use of special force capability. Thousands of students in Hong Kong have converged on a university campus to begin a week-long boycott of classes. They're protesting against China's stance on electoral reform in the territory. Students from more than two dozen institutions are taking part. It's been reported that Ukrainian military are moving heavy weapons back from pro-Russia rebel lines in the east. Ukrainian authorities and separatists agreed on a complete ceasefire and buffer zone early on Saturday in talks in Belarus. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. James will return at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news. And then after that, our culture editor, Robert Bound, will bring you a box-fresh episode of Culture. In the meantime, though, back we go to Midori House, where the time here in London is 18:32, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world. Today, Liam Aldous, our man in Spain, awaits with news of what the Catalonians are doing to try and compensate for the mess that was the No campaign in Scotland. The Yes campaign in Scotland. I still got so confused.
Well, the Catalan authorities are conveniently ignoring the no vote in Scotland and pushing ahead with their own independence move. On Friday, the day after the vote in Scotland, they actually approved a referendum law, which was widely expected to be timed with a victory in Scotland. But unfortunately for them, it kind of dented their momentum. However, they passed the law. However, the law itself is actually unconstitutional. So the Spanish government, the government in Madrid, which has been largely silent on this issue, basically just ignoring all the clamour coming from Catalonia, is actually going to be forced to act soon. So basically what's going to happen in the next few days, no one knows when this law is actually published in the parliamentary bulletin, the government will convene an emergency cabinet meeting and basically oppose this law in the constitutional court. So this will be repealed straight away. But the interesting thing is whether the government in Catalonia will go ahead with the referendum anyway.
I mean, just if you wouldn't mind clarifying, I'm not remotely expecting you to be a constitutional lawyer on this, but what is this law that's going to be repealed all about?
So basically, the law is they've just approved a law to hold a referendum. In Spain, the constitution says you can't, as a region, you can't just hold a referendum to be independent. Obviously, Spain is a very diverse country, and when the constitution was formed in the late 70s, there was a big focus on keeping the integrity of Spain together. So obviously, Catalonia has just gone ahead and created its own law, but they're living in a parallel universe because the constitution doesn't allow it. But basically, the alternative is if they actually abide by the constitutional court's ruling, they may hold early elections. And this is going to be interesting because Esquerra Republicana, which is quite a radical independence party, is actually expected to win. And this is the same party that has actually called for a campaign of civil disobedience if the constitutional court overrules this law. So we're in for some interesting times.
I mean, there is enough brouhaha in the United Kingdom about what last week's election, last week's referendum meant for the constitution and for the unity of a country. But it sounds like the United Kingdom took a far more grown-up approach to the way that the politics should be carried out. If you have the likes of unconstitutional laws being put forward, civil disobedience campaigns being mooted, what does that say, and what's been the reaction in Spain to the way that the politicians have been handling all this?
Well, that's a very interesting point. Obviously, there's been a lot of critics here saying the whole process in the United Kingdom was a lot more grown up. And in Spain, the problem is that the central government is just ignoring the problem, hoping it will go away. But it's just actually augmenting the sense that that Spain or Madrid isn't listening to Catalonia's problems or their demands. So obviously, like I said, there's probably going to be some kind of referendum or some kind of vote on independence, and the whole debate is centered on letting Catalonia decide. So the government in Catalonia wants to be able to use this expression of the people through a vote to then continue with their momentum towards independence.
All right, so we have a slightly bonkers process going through in the parliamentary situation. In Madrid, they seem to have lost their minds when it comes to public figures.
Yes. There's some very unusual things happening in Madrid. Some strange characters are making their mark on the city. First, we had an announcement a few months ago that Margaret Thatcher would be getting her own plaza. And it's actually turned into a reality. Basically, the sign went up just last week. And this is the brainchild of our controversial mayor, who actually also announced that she won't be standing for elections next year. So this is part of her legacy, I guess. And a lot of people are scratching their head. Why do we have a Margaret Thatcher Plaza? She doesn't have any connection to the city at all, other than the fact that she's an idol of our mayor, who's quite conservative herself. So the sign itself actually has already been defaced. So you can see the reaction it's provoked.
So we have a mayor deciding that part of his city wants to be named after Margaret Thatcher. Fair enough. But he's taken another angle as well, sort of another political angle in a slightly more crackers way. I'm quite baffled by what's happening in Madrid.
Oh yeah, let me elaborate. So there's another character who's going to make their mark in Madrid. This Friday, Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to be named the ambassador for Madrid tourism, and everyone is just saying, why have they chosen Arnold Schwarzenegger? Apparently, the rationale is it's a bit thin. Is that Arnold Schwarzenegger hosts his bodybuilding event, the Arnold Classic, here in Madrid. It's been going for 4 years. It actually brought 40,000 people to the city last year. So I have to say, the connection that Arnold Schwarzenegger has to Madrid is at least a little stronger than Margaret Thatcher, but it's still a strange choice to choose a man like the governator and turn him into an ambassador. It just doesn't make sense. But once again, it's going to be part of Ana Botella's amazing legacy.
I mean, just thinking, if I was sitting in Madrid doing a little bit of city branding, yes, Arnold Schwarzenegger wouldn't be the first person to pop into my head when it came to the Spanish capital. But it has got everybody talking, if for all the wrong reasons.
Well, I guess, I mean, I don't know, you could say all publicity is good publicity, but I think it's a strange choice, particularly because Madrid does have a bit of a challenge as far as tourism is concerned. There was just figures released today that Spain actually had 9.1 million visitors in the month of August, but Madrid's figures are still trailing and actually have fallen in the last 3 years. So there's obviously Madrid needs to do something to cash in on the growing numbers in Spain, but the people aren't coming to the capital. And Madrid has a lot to offer. It's the biggest city in Spain. There's a lot of culture. The people are lovely. But then they've got they're making decisions naming Arnold Schwarzenegger as their ambassador. You think they seem to be a little desperate.
It may be, but they may have an enormously untapped source of bodybuilders who may suddenly find Madrid the place to go. Liam Aldous, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we talk a little bit of philosophy, so do settle yourself and get comfy.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show.
I look at it and I think, God, could I have really lived like that? Could it have really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it.
Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. My next guest has published no fewer than 12 books in the last 14 years. He's Professor of Philosophy at the New School in New York and prompts the kind of accolades in the press usually reserved for a boy band, a superstar of philosophy, no less. Simon Critchley, you can hear him laughing in the background. He has a new book out. It's called Memory Theatre, and he joins me in the studio now. Simon, clearly I do have to ask you, why do you find being called a superstar of philosophy so funny?
It's not true. No, it's bizarre.
It is quite strange, because you do get figures who sort of pop up and are suddenly get described as superstars of philosophy, and almost their persona becomes more important than what they say. I mean, what's it like being sort of slotted into that category?
Enormously gratifying. I'm very, very flattered, because I'm terribly vain. But I don't know what it means. I mean, I have my day job, which is teaching. And I take that seriously. And then this other stuff I do on the side. So it's, you know, it can be a bit of a problem sometimes, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there then.
Let's leave it there.
I won't pick too hard at that one. Let's talk about your book, Memory Theatre.
Memory Theatre.
Slim.
Very slim.
Very densely packed.
Pictures in.
We'll come to the pictures in a bit, but thank you very much for helping us along with the pictures. It is described on the back as a sort of a mixture of philosophy, memoir and fiction. And I must confess, having read it briefly and been a little bit thrown off guard, it all hinges on the discovery of a series of boxes. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book is a kind of fictional thing, but it relates to someone I actually knew called Michel Ard, who was a French philosopher that died about 15 years ago. And the story is about a series of boxes that turn up in my office at the University of Essex.
Which did happen.
Yeah, not quite in the way I tell it, but let's say it happened. And then in these boxes, I go through basically the contents of this philosopher's life, sifting through, and I describe, and I find these texts, and then I find these what I think are astrological charts. Michel was an astrologer, that was his great passion, and then I find these what I call these memory maps, which seem to be maps of the lives of philosophers who've died, and I find these maps of philosophers who are still living, and one of them is my own, which then predicts my future demise. And then I begin to kind of plan out that structure. And I construct, and I find this text by Michel on the art of memory. And so this whole weird book is a kind of conceit about memory systems, memory theatres, and then I begin to have hallucinations and move to the Netherlands.
This is one of the things. It starts off as a book where you're unpicking and unpacking these boxes, and you start talking about memory and what's called the theatre of memory and the idea of total recall.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, this is a book about this author's discovery of what's happened in his office. But then suddenly, when you get to the map of your astrological chart, I think you describe it as it feels like your destiny's just been mapped out for you.
Yeah.
And then suddenly on the next page, you've moved to the Netherlands almost to fulfill the promise of what's on the piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to put your life in order.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, what did you really do that? Because I got rather confused. I got rather sort of mystified by what was actually happening in this tale.
Oh, it's not an accurate memoir. It's a life which I really hope doesn't happen to me.
Did you really go to the Netherlands and prepare for your death?
No.
Right.
Well, in a way, I did. I do go to the Netherlands regularly, and it always feels that I die in a different way every time I go there. So in a way I did, and the empirical research for the book is incredibly accurate. So everything I say is true, but it's not exactly true in the way in which I say it. So I end up in the Netherlands building this weird memory theater, which is going to contain the sum of the entirety of my knowledge, my life, and everything that I know in this backyard of this house in Den Bosch in the Netherlands. And I then anticipate the moment of my death, and then I repeat and reenact this act of memory over weeks and months, and then I do not die.
What happens then?
And then things get even weirder. Then I start to write about it in the persona of the narrator in the story, who then conceives of another weirder memory theatre, which is going to be set on an island and where the whole of the universe would be repeated. So the text is a kind of experiment in kind of delusion, right? In forms of psychotic delusion, and it's a description of a universe without love for me.
It's a lonely place when you're trying to find yourself through your memory.
So it's what I really do not want to happen in my life. It's a kind of alternative negative memoir in a strange way, insofar as it's a memoir.
It is all packed into what, no fewer than just under 80 pages.
Sure.
And you've managed to take us on an enormously complicated journey in that time. What was it that made you embark upon this course of writing? Because it's not a book on philosophy, although there are elements where you start talking about philosophy.
Yeah.
It's not a memoir. It's not a true account of what happened, but it's not a novel.
No, it's a kind of mixed form, I guess. And I've been collaborating with writers over the years, and I've been experimenting with different forms over the years. And I wrote a book with my wife about Shakespeare, and this book appeared, as it were, at the end of that. So this act of, joint writing, which was a real act of love, this thing began to pop out, and it took about 3 or 4 weeks, and I couldn't stop it. And I don't know what it is. It's a good story, hopefully. It's a good, weird story. And the model, the book that it's based on largely, is a book called The Invention of Morel by an Argentinian writer called Cazares, and which is it's a kind of Robert Louis Stevenson yarn as well, the book.
Very briefly, you're not quite sure what it was. I think you've told one interviewer that it looks like a horrible ball of shit. Do you still agree with that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I feel very ambivalent about this whole thing. I mean, it's not something I feel happy. It feels incredibly painfully intimate. And there's some things in there in a kind of code, which I'd rather people didn't read.
If it's in code, if we don't know what the code is, we shall be happily, blissfully ignorant.
There we are.
Simon Critchley, your book is called Memory Theatre, out now. It's a short read. It's bonkers, but it's really quite good fun. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Time now for a bit of music here on Midori House. This is the Ting Tings. The Ting Tings with their latest song, Wrong Club. The time is 18:53 here in London. Time now for our review on Midori House. Today, the subject is art. I am delighted to say Ossian Ward is here, head of content at Listen Gallery here in London. Here, Ossian, to talk about dark and strange art and a monkey.
Yes.
Where do we begin? After that last item, frankly, I'm absolutely open to any suggestion.
All right, well, we can start gently. There's a great show of Mike Nelson presenting a collector's work at the Whitechapel, and what he's done. Mike Nelson, as you may remember, makes these kind of labyrinthine installations that you walk into. But here he's turned curator and merely sort of placed works on a sort of battered-looking plinth made out of, you know, normal kind of wood. And what doesn't sound very remarkable actually turns some of these works by the likes of Louise Bourgeois or Brancusi or Alberto Giacometti into a really kind of powerful little stage set on which these things, I mean, the Brancusi, I think it's supposed to sort of, it's one of his heads, these kind of golden bronzed heads, but it just kind of lies on the plinth looking very sort of bedraggled and strange. I'm sure it's supposed to lie like that, but you're used to seeing it on a plinth or on a white thing and, you know, looking pristine. But this looks kind of quite scary. And the work, you know, these Giacometti sort of striding off on this wooden platform make them look kind of, gives them a different edge. It's all quite dark, as I mentioned.
How much do you think that an exhibition like this is going to change the way people think about framing art? Because normally, as you know, think of Brancusi and it's all smooth, yeah, and beautiful and lovely and decorous, and you say it's knocked over sideways, yeah, perhaps, yeah, on a plinth.
No, well, that's, well, it makes you think about the way in which it's normally displayed, you know, makes you look at it possibly harder, I think. It makes you, you know, really focus on it. I can move on to another exhibition that made me look very deeply the other day called In Border Deep, which is by Pierre Huyghe. And I suppose that the difficulty there is not knowing where to start. So there's these three aquaria with kind of little bits of life forms in them. You can vaguely see they're sort of darkly lit. Again, the whole space is very dark.
So we're now in the whole realm of a total installation as opposed to just observing.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you can walk around. There's a statue that you approach when you first come in with a bit of moss on it, looking a bit like something that's been dragged in from outside. But until I found out, I wouldn't have known. You can actually touch, the sculpture is warm to the touch. So there's actually almost like a living, breathing body below the statue. So I think it's pumped full of hot water or something. You can't quite work it out. But then after that, you get to these vitrines, these aquaria, which it turns out, I think, are bits of lily that he nicked from Monet's garden. But, I mean, they're entire, it's like a biotropic installation. There's an entire world going on in there with mosquitoes being made, and you know, it's quite something to encounter that in a gallery.
It sounds like it's actually going back almost in a sort of like a geological examination of what's gone on.
Yeah, except that he also plays tricks by lighting it in a strange way, or making it so that I guess it has two-way mirrored glass that he can turn on and off with lights. So it's theatrical, you know, it's by no means a kind of natural history display. And then to make things weirder, there's a giant video in which it looks like a girl because of the mask, but it's actually, you realise the hairy arms slowly give it away, that it's a monkey wearing a girl's kind of face mask. It turns out this is a trained monkey that used to perform or actually waitress at a restaurant in Japan and has since, you know, been out of a job. And I think the idea is that this poor monkey now wandering around Fukushima is kind of left to its own devices. But the addition of the face is very strange because you're not quite sure. It does take about 5 minutes to work out what's actually going on in the film, but it all makes for one great big eerie experience.
So that's Pierre Huyghe at Hauser & Burth. Let's conclude with something very close to home.
Yes.
Listen.
Well, I mean, the natural world kind of disappearing and reappearing and falling apart happens in Listen. We've got this exhibition of Natalie Gerberg and Hans Berg, who's well known for these animations that she started out doing, very visceral, sexual things being eaten and quite gory and bursting apart. But she's kind of moved on a bit, and these are much These animations are quite beautiful, and they're all about liquefying things, coming back into different states of being, kind of gas, solid, liquid. But they're projected onto tables or into pots, or so there's no kind of traditional screen element. You're sort of left to walk around them. And her partner, Hans Berg, Swedish DJ and composer, makes all the music. So it sort of comes together in a big interactive sort of immersive world.
Ossian Ward from the Listen Gallery, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Jane Kinnaman and Robert Fox. My thanks too to our producer Isabel Kayser and our researchers Gaia Lutz and Rebecca Unger and our studio manager Chris Grimes. Up next after the news is Culture with Robert Bound. Then at 2200 hours, tune in to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24. Your hosts will be Dominic Reynolds and Andrew Muller. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
From London to Beijing,
this is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
to Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.